I appreciate the opportunity of coming into class today and to share, because I think if there's one area where I'm concerned as a Christian activist, it's in the area of the social problems that we face. And if there's any area that the university ought to be able to have an impact in the world, it's in the area of sociology. And yet, in the majority of the sociology faculties, they are not prepared enough to train students in this area. And what I'd like to do is present the various problems that we face in the nation, give some of the analysis of them that's offered in the university, and then share with you my analysis of the problem as a Christian activist, and then throw it open for questions. After traveling to more than 500 universities now in approximately 50 countries of the world, I've come to the conclusion that the social revolution, I believe there is a social revolution occurring today, is not revolutionary enough. The revolution that's occurring in the area of sociology today seems to be dealing with the symptoms of the surface manifestations to the preclusion of a deeper root cause or problem that we find in society. When I look at the political, economic, social exploitation, the hatred, the envy, the jealousy, the materialism that's inundated our society, I look at these basically as diseases. Now, every disease has two factors. One is the environmental factor, which assists the spread of the disease. And the other is the organism. Now, you cannot kill the organism by providing better housing. And yet, almost every social movement I know today seems to be dealing with the structures around man, whether they're social, political, economical, educational, etc., to the preclusion of the individual that makes up society. Now, no cook can make a good omelet out of poor eggs. Milovan Gilis, the Marxist theoretician from Yugoslavia, will probably be the next president there, at least he thinks so. He made this statement: he that would fundamentally change the world must first fundamentally interpret the problems and without error. Now, I think he's right. So let us look at some of the problems that we face. One is a problem of ignorance. And the solution offered for it is saying that if man knows better, he would do better. If he knows different, he would do different. Therefore, we need to bring the weight of education onto the scene and apply it. I was in the country of Suriname, in South America. How many of you here know where Suriname is? Maybe? Right, one person. That's average for a class. It's in South America. And I went up the Suriname River with a government agent and two sociology professors on a government grant. And we went back to what they said was 150 years back in culture. And if you'd been there, you'd have believed it. And we were driven out of one of the Bush Negro villages because some of the Amerai Indians had attacked him and killed several of the Bush Negroes. But we jumped in our canoes and we headed towards the center of the river. I think I was scared and the rest of them. I was paddling like mad. My side of the canoe kept going like that. But we got out in the center of the river, and I turned around to the government agent and I said, "Tell me, sir, what's the answer?" And immediately he retorted, "Education." I said, "Oh, come on." I said, "Look at my country, one of the most educated countries of history. And we've had Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, John Kennedy." I said, "After Robert Kennedy's death, in 7 days, 99 people died of gunshot wounds." I said, "An educated man has the same inward drives and compulsions and thinking his color skin is better than somebody else's, and a desire for power and envy and greed that usually no amount of education will eliminate." The head of the philosophy department at SMU spoke up when I was there, and he said, "Many times, Mr. McDowell, education augments these characteristics in a man's life." Gogol, the Russian dramatist, writing in The Overcoat, described it this way, quote, "How much inhumanity there is within man, how much furious rudeness in his refined, educated, good breeding. Oh God, even in man, whom the world professes noble and honorable," end quote. Now the humanist comes to me. He says, "What we need to do is take man, take his resources, spend a little time with him, educate him, and everything will change." Well, I really think the predicament of the humanist is the humanist predicament. I think humanism is part of the problem, not part of the solution. Then there are those, and I hear a lot of this now in Latin America and along the Mexican border, etc., that the basic problem today is a technological gap. What we need is an equilibrium between the underdeveloped, the developed, and superdeveloped countries of the world, and within the countries, between the underdeveloped and the superdeveloped areas of an economy. Therefore, we need to bring the weight of science and technology onto the scene and apply it. Che Guevara. Che Guevara was the Argentine revolutionary that put Fidel Castro in power. And then they had an ego problem there, and nationalism was coming up in Cuba, and they threw Che Guevara out, and he went to Bolivia to start the revolution. Not actually to start it, but to train men to begin a revolution 2 or 3 years later. And he was finally killed, part of the Bolivian army, the CIA, and then the peasants that turned him in to the army. Che Guevara was asked, What do you most admire of the American people? And he replied, their advanced technological skill. But look at technology. What's the common denominator? It's man. Sure, technology's put wonderful refrigerators in our kitchens, wheels underneath our feet, boob tubes in our living rooms. But at the same time, it's put more fear and apprehension in man's heart than any other time. Yes, it's given us hospitals, and yet it's given us the H-bomb and the megaton bomb. We know more about killing people than we do saving people. That's a problem of the United Nations. We've made nuclear giants out of moral midgets. Technology can light a beautiful city, like Atlanta, Georgia, can destroy it. The common denominator in technological use is man. The problem in ecology is not so much the use of technology, but the misuse of technology determined by the individual. This is why Einstein answered the question, what is the answer to the atomic bomb? He said, what is it we really fear? Is it the power of the atomic bomb? Or is it that force for evil in the human heart? In the name of God, if you believe in him, you better take him seriously. If not, we're all dead. End quote. Go see the show Tora, Tora, Tora. See how the Japanese and the Americans were motivated by pride and hatred and prejudices to make some of the stupidest decisions of history to lead to Pearl Harbor. And then to realize, since Pearl Harbor, man has not changed. And yet technology has brought us to the point of annihilation. And that should scare anyone. What we've done is made nuclear giants out of moral midgets or the governments today. Then there are those, and you used to hear a lot of it in the campus, and the student radicalism kind of died away, who are so naive to believe that all of the world's problems are rooted in the economic or political system. In other words, to change man, you change the structures around him. In other words, man is a product of society. So to change man, you change society, and man will be changed. Now the Marxist sings this tune, and he has certain good reasons for doing it. The Marxists would say that man is an economic creature. Now, I agree with the Marxists that man is an economic creature. Now, they get to it by saying that the basis of society is economic relationships. Therefore, and we're all social beings, and therefore, man is an economic creature because the basis of society is economic relationships. But I ask, why is man an economic creature? I believe basically because he's ambitious. Why is man ambitious? I believe because he's greedy. Even Dr. James Weaver, the new leftist spokesman, an economist at the American University in Washington, D.C., quoted in Time Magazine, which is a little better than Reader's Digest, he made this statement. He said, quote, "We would like to know if it is possible to run an economic system on something other than greed," end quote. And the last paragraph, he readily admitted, we don't have the slightest idea what that something other might be. Dr. James Ingle, who is one of the world's leading consumer behavior consultants, formerly at Ohio State University, now at Wheaton College. If you ever take a course in consumer behavior research or studies, your textbook, I'm sure, would be by James Ingle, Blackman and Koch. I had an interview with Dr. Ingle, and he shared this with me. He said, after years of studying consumer behavior research, he came to the conclusion that society does not make man greedy, but man basically is greedy and will produce a greedy society. Marshall I. Goldman of the Russian Research Department at Harvard University. He said after studying planned societies like socialist societies in the Soviet Union, etc., he came to the conclusion that society does not make man materialistic, but man is basically in his nature materialistic and will produce a materialistic society. But I ask, why is man greedy? I believe because he's self-centered. I don't think the natural state of man is a democracy, a republic, or a free enterprise, or a capitalistic society. And believe me, I do not think it's a socialistic or communistic society that's a natural state of man. The natural state of man is anarchy. Every man for himself. And what do we have to deal with that anarchy in human nature? This is why Dr. Palmiro Togliatti, the former head of the Communist Party in Italy, writing an address called The Destiny of Man, made this statement, quote, "We no longer accept the naive and mistaken view that an increase in knowledge and a change in the social structures are enough by themselves to bring about a radical change in man. This view, inherited from the Enlightenment of the 1800s and Marxism in the 1900s, has been refuted by history," end quote. When I was living in Argentina, I lived near a compound of Russians, and I love to talk to economists, and I was talking to this Russian economist. And he made this statement. He said, Josh, the Russian peasant has proven more than anything else in history that the theory to change man, you change his environment, will ever work. Because he's still out to get as much as he can for himself. What these people are saying is that if you take man, cram him in that perfect society, he'll see the benefits of it. He'll see it's better to give than to receive, better to love than to be loved, and everything will be changed. What I really think they're trying to do is this, is go out and catch a skunk, bring a skunk into the house, change his environment, apply the shower of technology to him, put a red rim around his neck, spray cologne on, call him Old Spice. Sure, his environment's been changed, he's been powdered in perfume, but his basic nature has not been changed. And as a farm boy, I can well testify what happens when that skunk gets scared. And this is why Gorgiai, the Russian poet, in the poem, The Tale of the Eagle, I think it's on page 273 of his major works. He described man's predicament. Now, it's his description, not mine. He described man like a snake. Here was a snake confined to the dust of the ground, but the snake didn't want to be that way. The snake wanted to be free from the dust of the ground. One day, an eagle flew over. And the snake wanted to be like that eagle. You know, sometimes you see a bird fly by and just wish you could put some wings on and get away from it all. I used to feel that way, and I became a Christian. Now I got to get involved in it all. So this snake, wanting to be like an eagle, crawled up in a cliff, and he threw himself off to fly, and he fell to his death. And Gorgiai concluded by saying, born to crawl, one cannot fly. When I look at the political, economic, social exploitation, the hatred, the envy, the greed, the racism, the prejudices that have inundated our society, I look at these men and women basically as individual problems, which become the problems of man collectively and society as a whole. And until men are changed individually, society will never be changed collectively. Look at racism. Racism isn't a problem. It's not a problem at all. It's a surface manifestation of a deeper root problem within the heart of man. Every one of the 50 countries that I've been in has been a racist society. Every single one. I've never been in a country that wasn't a racist society. It's a universal problem. You could do away with racism today, and you'd still have killing, murder, prejudices, biases. Look what the blacks did to the blacks in Biafra. Look what the whites are doing to the whites in Ireland. Look what the Bolivians recently did to the Bolivians. That's why I agree with Senator Aikens of Vermont. He said if we were to wake up some morning, find everyone the same color skin, by 12 o'clock noon, we'd find something else to be prejudiced about. And you know, I think he has a point there. Almost every problem we face is an individual problem. Now this is why I, as an individual, started to consider a man that lived almost 2,000 years ago. And that man was Jesus of Nazareth. Now, a lot of times when I mention Jesus, a few people laugh or kind of ridicule. That's okay. The thing that made Jesus different wasn't his long hair, the way he dressed. It was his quality of life, and we could use a little more of that today. Now, Jesus taught there was an educational problem. All you have to do is go to Latin America and see how our government gives a man a dollar, and he'll feed himself for a day. You can teach a man how to fish, and he'll feed himself for a lifetime. Jesus taught there were technological problems. All you have to do is travel in our country of 200 and some million people and see that close to 6% go to bed starving at night. There's something wrong. Jesus was more vocal than most of the voices we used to hear on the campus about the problems and the structures around man, political, economic, social, etc. But Jesus, to me, was a true radical. Now, I use the correct sense of the word radical. It comes down to us through the Latin radicai. And it means to get to the root of the matter, not to dink off in the periphery. Well, Jesus said the basic problem is in the heart of the individual. It's kind of like Gunnar Myrdal, the Swedish sociologist that came to our country to study the social problems that we have. And in his monumental work, The American Dilemma, he concluded that the basic problem of America is in the heart of the individual. This is why in John 2, Jesus went up to Jerusalem. He was doing some mighty works up there. In those days, they'd probably say he was doing miracles. Where I'm from, here in California, they'd probably say that he was tripping out. And he got a big following. And let's face it, in that day as well as ours, when somebody gets a big following, there's two types of people like to jump in the bandwagon. One, the religious leaders get a few more coins in the offering plate. And second, the political leaders get a few more votes. And after this last election, it's kind of like being in church, get a few more coins in the offering plate, and you go to a political rally. And so the religious political leaders came to Jesus. And they said, look, Jesus, we want to call ourselves by your name. We want to be your disciples. We want to be your followers. But Jesus had the guts to do something a lot of people don't today. Jesus turned around and he said, no. They said, what? You don't want us in your team? Look, we got the administration label. Why? Jesus went on to testify why. He said, no one needs to testify to me of man, for I know what is in the heart of the individual. In John 3, Jesus was up at Jerusalem again, and he met this religious fanatic. Now, fanatic to me is someone that cannot change his mind, will not change his subject, and I usually fit into that. And this guy was a religious leader of the Jews. He was a Pharisee. This character was so religious, he prayed 7 times a day. Now, that's a lot of praying. He was so religious, he went to the synagogue to worship God 3 times a day. As far as the moral law was concerned, he was above reproach. He's probably the model citizen. They probably made Nicodemus watches. I'm sure he's a member of the Jerusalem JCs and Nazarene Rotary Club. The model citizen. Yet, this man saw in the life of Jesus a different quality of life altogether. But he was a coward like a lot of people today, you know, afraid to be identified with Jesus in public. So he got him alone on the rooftop. And I liked to have been there. And a conversation kind of went like this. He said, look, Jesus, or I think it was Rab, we know that you must be a teacher come from God, for no one can do what you do and say what you do except God be with him. Jesus turned around and says, Nick, except a man be born again, he'll never enter into the kingdom. Well, Nicodemus probably reached up and rubbed his hair a piece and said, hey, just a minute. How in the world can a man enter a second time into his mother's womb and be born? It'd be a little rough. Well, Jesus went on to explain what he meant. And it was basically this. Nicodemus, your problem is not within you. I mean, not without you. Not the structures around you. It is within you. And what you need is a rebirth. I like that. Maybe that's what Reich was trying to get at in Greening Up America, which has kind of turned to bluey now. In Conscience 3, I believe what we need is a power that cannot just change the structures around man, but can literally revolutionize man from the inside out. Martin Buber, a tragic cry towards the end of his life, a fine moral effort, said, quote, isn't there any force in the world can change that intractable thing, human nature? There is a tragedy at the heart of things, end quote. Look at peace. Everybody's crying out, peace, peace, peace. Get out of Vietnam, we had peace. We got out of Vietnam, we have Ireland. We got out of Ireland, you have the Middle East. Get out of the Middle East, it's going to be somewhere else. Have you ever really analyzed peace? Will we ever have international peace and we have national peace? Will we ever have national peace and we have peace in the local level? Will we ever have peace in the local level and do we have peace in that dynamic individual level of personal relationships? Men and women, that's where peace starts. In your life, in my life, that's where love starts, in your heart, in my heart, and it spreads from there. And this is where I believe Jesus Christ is relevant. In that dynamic individual level of personal relationships. Now, I'm not speaking about organized Christianity or institutionalized religion. I'm talking about a relationship with a living, dynamic Jesus Christ. Now, let me bring it right down to where we live. I guess Goodyear would say, or maybe it's Goodrich, where the rubber meets the road. In the South, I think they'd say where the fork meets the grits. I think the happiest thing to a Southerner is a 20-pound grit. But let me just bring it right down to where we live. When I dropped out of law school and went on to theological seminary and then started to travel, I had to be experiencing what I was talking about. I don't appreciate hypocrites. And let me just personally share with you what happened in my life. Dynamic relationships with other people and with Jesus Christ. Several years ago, my life was like a lot of students right here in this university. It was described by Thomas Aquinas, and he said, there's within every soul restless thirst for happiness and meaning. I wanted to be happy you didn't want to be. I wanted to be one of the happiest individuals in the entire world. What's wrong with that? More than that, I wanted meaning to life. I wanted the answers to the questions, who am I? Why am I here? Where am I going? Even more than that, I wanted to be free. I wanted to be one of the freest individuals in the entire world. Now, freedom to me is not going out and do what you want to do. Any idiot can do that, and there's plenty doing it. Freedom to me is to have the power to do what you know you ought to do. See, most people know what they ought to do, but they don't have the power to do it. They're not free, they're in bondage. So I started looking for answers. Well, you know, in California, everybody has a bag of religion. So I took off for church. I mean, I went in the morning, I went in the afternoon, I went in the evening. I think some of you know what I'm talking about. I must have found the wrong church. I felt worse inside than I did outside. And I was always very practical, and something didn't work, I chucked it. So I chucked religion. But the only thing I ever got out of religion is when I put 25 cents in the offering, took 35 out for a milkshake. I made about 25 cents a week. Then I thought, well, maybe education is the answer. I looked at a success-oriented, materialistic society, educated society, and I figured where the cream rises to the top, it must be the educated people, have that inner joy, that happiness, that power to be free. So I went and enrolled in university. I didn't know any better. And I spent hours rapping with many students like some of you. Not about the problems. The 500 universities I've been in, you find 1,001 students talk about problems. I wanted solutions. I wanted something that would change my life in relationship with other people. I was one of the most unpopular students of the professors in the first university I went to. I used to buttonhole those men in their offices. I'm sure when some of them saw me coming, they used to pull the shades and turn the lights off. Oh, my economics theory professor, Dr. Sheldon, he could sure tell me how to make a better living, but he couldn't tell me how to live better. And it didn't take me long to realize that these students in my faculty had more problems, less meaning to life, more frustration I had. That wasn't a very exciting revelation. Then I thought, well, maybe prestige is the answer. Get involved, become a leader. So I ran for freshman class president, had a dirty campaign, got elected. It was neat, knowing everybody on campus, making the decisions, spending the students' money, getting the speakers I wanted to get in to influence them. And it was great, but it seemed to wear off like everything else. Every Monday morning, I'd wake up, usually the same Josh McDowell, usually with a headache because of the night before and the attitude, well, here goes another 5 days. I kind of endured Monday through Friday. Happiness evolved around 3 nights a week, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and then went out and started a vicious cycle all over again. You know, there's a biblical term to describe a life like that. It's one hell of a life to live. But I couldn't find anyone living any other way, and I couldn't find anyone that could tell me how I could live differently. About that time, I became frustrated, not desperate. I have never been desperate, not like some students. You know the number one killer of university students today is suicide? Fact is, of 24 months ago, you can take all the other causes of the deaths of university students, add them together, will not equal suicide. From what I understand, it's 9-to-1 girls over guys in the university and suicide. Well, I wasn't that desperate, but let me tell you, there weren't too many people in universities in this country more sincere in trying to find meaning, truth, and purpose in life than I was, and I hadn't found it. About that time, I was quite fortunate. I didn't realize it all. But in and around the university, I saw a small group of people. I don't want to mislead you. There weren't very many. There were about 8 students and 2 faculty members. But there was something different about their lives. They seemed to know where they were going. Now, that's unusual in the university. They seemed to know why they believe what they believe. I don't know about you men and women here, but I like to be around people that know why they believe what they believe. I don't care if they don't agree with me. Some of my closest friends are opposed to some things I believe. But I admire a man or a woman with convictions. I don't meet a whole lot. But when I meet them, I'll listen to them. Because I believe I can learn something from them if I don't agree with them. At least I get their point of view. These people didn't talk about love. They got involved. They seem to be riding above the circumstances, university life. Everybody else is kind of under the pile. And you know one important thing I noticed was this? They didn't seem to have a happiness dependent on outward circumstances. There seemed to be an inner constant source of joy. I guess they were those type of people you meet, they're just disgustingly happy. Well, they had something I didn't have. And like the average student, when somebody had something I didn't have, I wanted it. So I remember I made friends with them. After a couple of weeks, we're sitting around the table in the student center. And it was really funny. Of all things, the conversation started to get to God. Well, let's face it. If you're an insecure student or an insecure professor and the conversation gets to God, you have to put on the big front. I mean, every campus has a big mouth. I'm sure you have one here. You know, the guy says, oh, Christianity. That's for the weaklings. It's not intellectual. And the key is this. Usually, the bigger the mouth, the bigger the vacuum. Well, I was putting on the front, but they were bugging me. So finally, I looked over at this girl, and she was a good-looking girl. I used to think all Christians were ugly. But I looked over at this girl, and I kind of leaned back in my chair because I didn't want them to think I was interested. They probably wouldn't have believed it anyway. And I just, and excuse me, ladies, for the language I used then, I know better now. But I kind of leaned back in my chair and I said, tell me, honey, what changed your lives? Why are your lives so different than the other students, the leaders on campus? Why? I couldn't believe that girl. She looked back at me with a little smile. Said 2 words I never thought I'd hear as the answer in the university. She just looked back and said, Jesus Christ. I said, oh, for God's sakes. Don't give me that garbage. I'm fed up with religion. I'm fed up with the church. I'm fed up with the Bible. Don't give me that garbage about religion. All I know is that girl had a lot of guts or a lot of convictions. In fact, I think she had both. She shot back at me eye to eye. Didn't even smile this time. She said, Mister, I didn't tell you religion. I told you the person of Jesus Christ. And you know, she pointed out something to me I never knew until I got to university. That Christianity is not a religion, but a relationship with the living Christ. Religion is man through good works and ritualism trying to work his way to God. Christianity is God coming to man through Jesus in a relationship. Well, I apologized to her. I hadn't been brought up to be rude. I was brought up in one of those little dinky towns in Michigan. You have them in this state. I've driven through them. Kind of plugging your razor and the streetlights dim, you know. You just kind of know everyone. You're supposed to be polite and everything. And I said, young lady, please forgive me for my attitude. But I said, I've had so many bad trips to religion. I've had so many bad experiences with it. I don't want anything to do with it. Then you know what happened? I couldn't believe it. Right there in the university. These students and professors challenged me as a pre-law student. Oh, this was funny. They challenged me to intellectually examine the claims of Jesus Christ as God's Son. To use my mind to look at history that God, Christ was God's Son, died on the cross for his sins, was buried, and raised again the 3rd day. Well, I was thinking like some of you are. I thought that was a farce. I thought most Christians are like 2 professors I had in university. I figured he had 2 brains. One was lost and the other was out looking for it. I really believed that most Christians were walking idiots. Figured, you know, shelved brains run on vacuum. Well, these people kept challenging me over and over and over again to make an examination of it. So finally, I accepted their challenge. And I have to say, out of pride, I didn't do it to prove anything, but I did it to refute him. Ooh, I used to wait for that Christian to speak up in the classroom. I mean, I'd tear him or her up one side, down the other side, and beat the insecure professor to the punch. But I didn't know there were facts. I didn't know there was evidence that a man could take his mind and evaluate. I had a problem. After 2 years of trying to refute Christianity, I couldn't. And intellectually, I came to the conclusion that Jesus Christ must have been who he claimed to be. In fact, I had a problem. My mind told me this was true, but my will was way over here. You see, I found out becoming a Christian was a rather ego-shattering experience. Jesus Christ made a direct challenge to my will to trust him as Savior and Lord, to come into my life, like it says in John 1:12, but to as many as received him, to them gave he the right to become a child of God. In Revelation 3:20, Jesus said, "Behold, I am standing at the door of your life and knock. If any man hear my voice and open the door, I will come into him." Well, I don't care if he did walk on water, turn water to wine, I wouldn't pledge him in my house. I mean, no one was going to tell me what to do. And here's my mind telling me it's true, my will was way over here. And every time I was around those cotton-picking Christians, that conflict used to get just like this. You ever been around happy people and you're miserable? Then they'd bug you. Boy, they'd irritate me. They'd be so happy, and I'd be so miserable, I'd literally get up and run right out of the student union. Finally, I got so I'd go to bed at 10 o'clock at night, and I couldn't get to sleep until 4 o'clock in the morning. And I knew I had to get it off my mind before I went out of my mind. Now, I was always open-minded about it. Not like some people, it's open-minded, their brains would fall out. But I was open-minded. So December 19, 1959, at 8:39, second year in university, I put it to the test. And I became a Christian. He says, "Oh, how do you know?" I said, "Look, I was there. Changed my life." That night I prayed. Now, you never caught me praying much. But that night I prayed four things that literally transformed my life in this relationship with this living Christ. I said, "Lord Jesus, thank you for dying on the cross for me. Second, I said, I confess there's things in my life unpleasing to you, and I ask you to forgive me. Third, I said, right now, the best way I know how, I open the door of my heart and life and accept you as my Savior and Lord. Take over the throne of my life. Change me from the inside out." Last thing I prayed was just, "Thank you for coming into my life by faith." Not faith based upon ignorance, huh? Faith based upon evidence and facts of history and God's Word. But nothing happened. I mean, nothing. One day, a bolt of lightning came out of the sky and kind of slapped me upside the head. I didn't sprout wings or anything. Tell you the truth, I actually felt worse after I made that decision. I kind of felt like I was going to vomit. I kind of said, "Oh no, McDowell, what'd you get sucked into now?" You know, I really felt that I'd gone off the deep end. Like some of you probably think I did. Well, let me tell you, in 6 months to a year and a half, I found out I hadn't gone off the deep end. I mean, my life was changed. I was in a debate with a professor of the history department at Kansas State University, and I got to this part of the debate, and he interrupted me and said, "You're trying to tell us that God changed your life in the 20th century? What area?" After 45 minutes, he said, "Okay, that's enough." One was in the area of restlessness. I always had to be occupied. I had to be over to my girl's place, over to the guy's place in a rap session. I'd walk across the campus. My mind was like a labyrinth with conflict bouncing around the wall. I'd sit down, try to study or cogitate, and I couldn't. But after I made that decision for Christ, only positive thinking, I arrived to the crisis I'm getting a little ahead of myself here, I think. After I came into this relationship with Christ, it was just kind of, I guess you'd have to call it a peace. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not talking about the absence of conflict. What I found this relationship with Jesus, not religion, was not so much the absence of conflict, but more the ability to cope with conflict. And I wouldn't trade that for anything in the world. Another area that started to change, the area of a bad temper. Boy, used to blow my stack. Somebody look at me cross-eyed and I'd straighten it for him. I still got the scars. Almost killed a young man my first year in the university in Michigan, A&W root beer stand. Almost got sent up for it. But after I made that decision for Christ, I only had positive thinking. I arrived to that crisis losing my temper, and it was gone. Not only my friends noticed it, but my enemies did a lot sooner. And only once now, in 14 years, have I lost my temper. I blew it that time and made up for about 6 years. The last area I want to share is one I'm not proud of. I'm ashamed of it. But the reason I share it is an area that a lot of people need to have changed in their lives. And I found the source of change through this relationship with Jesus Christ. The area of hatred. I had a lot of hatred in my life. Now, it wasn't something outwardly manifested. It was more of an inward grinding. I had racial hatred. I hated the black man, the red man, the white man, even the yellow man. I'll tell you why. Like so many other people. I was insecure. I'll admit it. I was insecure. And every time I met someone different than I was, they became a threat to me. But there was one man that I hated more than anyone else in the whole world. I hated his guts. And that was my father. To me, he was a town drunk. I hardly ever knew him sober until I was 20 years old. Remember, I used to go to high school. My friends would come make jokes about my father downtown in the gutter making it of himself. They didn't think it bothered me. See, I was like other people. I was laughing on the outside. But let me tell you, I was crying on the inside. I'd go out in the barn and see my mother lying in the gutter in the manure behind the cows, being so bad my father she couldn't get up and walk. We used to have friends over, and my brother and I take my father out in the barn, tie him up, park the car up around the sala, and tell the friends he had to go an important call so he wouldn't be embarrassed. I don't think anyone could have hated anyone more than I did my own dad. But after I made that decision for Christ, something happened. A love, I can only say the love of God through Jesus Christ inundated my life. I'll never forget the day that I was in a serious car accident. I was taken home. My legs, arm, and neck contraction. My father came into the room, and he asked me this question. He said, "Son, how can you love a father such as I?" I said, "Dad, 6 months ago, I despised you." Then I shared with him my conclusions about Jesus Christ. I said, "Dad, all I can say is that in this relationship, I found the capacity to love and accept not only you, but other people just the way they are." Well, 45 minutes later is one of the greatest thrills of my life. When some of my own family, someone that I couldn't pull the wool over their eyes, somebody that knew me, my own father said to me, "Son, if God can do in my life what I've seen him do in yours, then I want to give him the opportunity." And right there, I asked him if he'd like to pray to receive Christ, and he said yes. And right there, my father prayed with me. And all I can say is my life was changed in 6 months, a year, and a year and a half. The life of my father was changed right before my eyes. It was like somebody reached out and turned on a light bulb. I never saw it before. I've never seen it since. Such a rapid change. Even though I've literally seen thousands upon thousands of university students and professors and lay people, lives transformed through this relationship, usually over a period of several weeks, months, or a year. You know, my father only touched whiskey once after that. He got it with his lips, and that was it. He didn't need it anymore. 14 months later, he died because 3/4 of his stomach had to be removed through 40-some years of drinking. But in that 14-month period, scores of people in my hometown and surrounding area committed their lives to Jesus Christ because of the changed life of the town drunk, my dad. I've come to one conclusion. Jesus Christ changes lives. And this is my thesis. It is not enough to change the structures around man without concomitantly changing the individual that makes it up. Because until men are changed individually, society will not be changed collectively. And I propose as that part of the solution for changing man from the inside out, a relationship with Jesus Christ. Now, some of you might not agree with me. That doesn't bother me. But I think if any of you come to the conclusion or study the problems, you'll come to the conclusion that individuals need to be changed. If you don't agree with me in the solution being in the person of Jesus Christ, then I'll challenge you to find something that will change man from the inside out, to get off the fence and to give your life to it. But I've never found anything that changes man in his basic nature over such a long period of time consistently than being born again through this relationship. When I was lecturing at Duke University, a student wrote in the door, "We have met the enemy, and he is us." I wrote underneath, "I've met part of the solution, and he is Jesus."